Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. New Hampshire asked the state Supreme Court to overturn a lower court decision stating New Hampshire is not providing an adequate education. Parents and activists in the capital city pushed the Concord School Board to remove two administrators accused of mishandling allegations of sexual misconduct. And Democratic State Senator Dan Feltes officially enters the race for governor. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. If you have questions or comments, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today. You can find that at our Facebook page. Again, just search for NHPR Exchange. That is all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and NHPR education reporter Sarah Gibson. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here.
Hey, Peter.
You're welcome.
So, Sarah, we'll start with you. Big news regarding something that you've reported extensively on, an adequate education. In June, a judge ruled that the state is not meeting its obligation to provide an adequate education. And now the state is appealing to the Supreme Court, saying that that judge was wrong. So, Sarah, on what grounds does the state argue that the judge was wrong?
So the state's main concern with the judge's ruling is that it was based on arguments by the plaintiffs that took numbers from the state, but numbers that are reported by the district about expenditures. So basically, the plaintiffs were saying, hey, look, we spend X amount of money on transportation. We spend, look at how much we're spending on teachers. Look at how much we're spending on X, Y, and Z. And the state argues that this is not actually the cost of an adequate education as defined by the legislature. It's the cost that the districts have decided to put up in order to fund the kind of education they want their students to have. So they say that there's kind of a conflation between a, quote, adequate education and the costs that districts have decided to incur and levy on the taxpayers.
So let's dig deep into that definition of adequate. How does the state define spending on an adequate education? How much time do we have, really?
Well, I mean, do you have 5 hours? But in all seriousness, it's quite complicated. But basically, the overview is that back in the late 90s, we had a series of Supreme Court cases about this very thing, whether or not the state should pony up more money for education. And there's a formula that was developed by lawmakers in the early 2000s, and we're essentially relying on that. It's been tweaked a little bit, and the way it was developed was to look at pretty medium-performing schools, to look at their costs, to take into account their student-teacher ratios, see what they're spending money on, and say, hey, let's just say it's about $4,000, a little less than $4,000 per pupil, and that has not risen very much at all in the last 20 years. There's a little bit more money thrown in for a student who has special needs, a student who's learning English, or a student who comes from a low-income family. But in general, it's far less than what districts are actually spending per student.
Dean.
Yeah, the state currently gives about $3,500 per student, as Sarah mentioned. This was determined by a legislative committee about 11 years ago, so the formula hasn't really changed. The plaintiffs are claiming that the cost is actually closer to about $19,000, and they're looking for something like $10,000 to $11,000 per pupil to be given by the state. And, you know, this comes at a time we're in the middle of a bit of a budget crisis here. We've had this three-month continuing resolution. Governor Sununu and Democrats in the state legislature are negotiating over things like education spending. And there's been a big debate about whether or not Democrats, by putting in this additional, I think it's over $100 million, are creating unfunded mandates. And Governor Sununu is willing to give some money to deal with some of the issues. But they're still negotiating that. So to have this additional potential funding issue on top of it is very challenging. And I will say, and we can talk about this, you know, the courts have said continually for 20 years now, this is not adequate legislature. You need to do something. This has to come from the legislature. That's where the power of the purse resides. And it's just been really difficult. As I was telling you before the show, I remember being on the exchange 15 years ago or so talking about John Lynch and how we're going to figure out how to fund an adequate education through, you know, more money, statewide property tax, constitutional amendment to the state constitution. Yeah, we've been talking about this for 20 years.
And so just to summarize, to make sure I have this right, Sarah, so it's going to come down to sort of a disagreement about what is the definition of an adequate education, apart from the sort of raw numbers that the legislature years ago has decided.
Yeah, so two things need to be figured out. If the lawmakers, in fact, take seriously their duties, it's to define and probably redefine an adequate education, given the fact that the current formula, the courts have said, is not working. So to define that adequate education and then to figure out how to fund it, both of those things the lawmakers need to figure out. The courts can't say, hey, so I think it's about $15,000 per pupil that the state should be spending, and here's how you fund it. You need to implement a new kind of tax, or you need to raise business taxes. That is not up to the courts. That's up to lawmakers. And we saw that debate play out this past year. We've seen it play out to differing levels for decades now.
So the court can say, the Supreme Court could side with Conval and the other school districts and say, hey, legislature, you need to figure this out. Is there, how would you enforce that? Like, how would the courts say, all right, legislature, get to work? Like, they're separate but co-equal branches of government. Like, is there a way to enforce that?
I think that the education funding lawsuits in New Hampshire have been a real testament to the limitations of the courts. And you can have, you know, the highest court in the state say over and over again, what is happening right now is not constitutional. But if it's up to lawmakers ultimately to make that constitutional and they shirk those duties, as the lower court has said and as the plaintiffs in the Conval case say, it's ultimately kind of at a standstill. I think many would also say it requires a lot of leadership in the state house. And both Democratic and Republican governors have been faulted for not making this a core issue that they campaign on and that they commit to taxpayers on in their time in Concord.
Yeah, it's just as Sarah laid out, it's a very difficult issue. It involves questions about, you know, local property tax burdens and how much the state should be contributing. And, you know, the courts can say you need to do something, but what is actually done is ultimately a political outcome. And that's why it's been so difficult. One other little short-term complication is that the state Supreme Court currently only has four justices sitting on it. You remember Attorney General McDonald was rejected by the executive council 3-2. Governor Sununu's nominee. So in theory, if they were to take this on as a four-person court, which they could do, you could have a split decision. They can also apparently choose somebody randomly from a lower court to sit in, or perhaps Governor Sununu will get somebody on the court before it goes to trial, before the final appeal is heard to the Supreme Court. We don't know that that's going to happen. So it's just a little additional interesting complication. But in the end, this is going to have to come out of the legislature.
It's also worth noting that, many Republicans were deeply disappointed back in the day when the Supreme Court did rule in favor of poor districts, in favor of education funding. They really felt like it was an overstep of the court, and it was kind of liberal justices saying, you guys need to basically tax New Hampshire residents more, or you need to introduce an income tax. It was kind of a backdoor way to increase taxes. So that was one of the kind of stories about the decision of the Supreme Court in the past, and it was really criticized by a lot of people concerned about state spending. The makeup of the court is different now, and some education funding advocates I've spoken to are concerned about this case going before the Supreme Court now, because it is considered by some to be a more conservative Supreme Court than back in the day when those education funding lawsuits were decided.
So throughout all this, Sarah, what are you hearing from school districts as they face this uncertainty?
The uncertain, which kind of uncertainty, Peter? The uncertainty about the Convel case the budget?
I would say, you tell me, which is more important, I think, from the people that you've been talking to.
Yeah, the one that's way more important is the fact that we have a continuing resolution with the budget, but we don't actually know how much money the state is going to be spending to school districts. You know, the reality is that school districts are kind of used to these percolating lawsuits in the background. They're certainly paying attention, but they know this could take years. So the real thing that is on superintendents and school boards and teachers' minds right now is how much money are we getting from the state to fund our school district this coming year?
And we heard testimony in the state legislature, I believe it was last week, from a number of these school districts, particularly some in the North Country, who are really struggling and need the money, and it makes it very difficult to plan. A lot of teacher cuts, a lot of program cuts, and that's the bigger context for the current negotiation between Governor Sununu and the state legislature on ultimately how much to fund. Not only how much money, but through what programs and how might it be allocated.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. If you have questions about the week's news, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page where we've got a live streaming video of this radio show today. Just go on over to Facebook, search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Sarah Gibson, also want to talk to you about what's been happening in Concord this week. In the Concord School District, two administrators are in the spotlight for the way they handled allegations of sexual assault and inappropriate behavior by a former teacher, Howie Lee Young. Bring us up to speed on the timeline of this case, Sarah.
Sure. So it started close to 5 years ago now. In 2014, middle school student Anna Goble brought concerns to teachers and administrators about the behavior of Howie Lee Young, who was a special ed teacher. She was suspended for, quote, malicious gossip. She was essentially punished for bringing up concerns. Then in 2018, so around a year ago, students alleged that they had seen Lee Young kissing a student in the parking lot. He remained on the job as investigations ensued. And then in April of 2019, just this past spring, there were revelations that he was facing actually multiple very serious charges of sexually assaulting a former student, both in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. And so and now there's a petition signed by close to 3,000 people asking for the board to fire Superintendent Terry Forston and Principal of Concord High, Tom Sicca. At least some of that is related to Howie Lee Young.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about this petition a little bit. This came up relatively recently. Why?
Yeah. So, well, let's back up just for a second to explain Principal Tom Sicca.
Yes,
he's
please.
Actually currently on administrative leave. He was the principal of the middle school and was the person who suspended the first student who brought concerns. And so when that family came to the district and said, look, you punished and shamed our daughter for bringing up concerns about someone who is an alleged perpetrator and predator, he was placed on administrative leave. He is currently the high school principal. So that's been the case since June. And then the superintendent was actually not in the district when that original suspension took place, but she did oversee, some of the decisions around Lee Young's continued employment for months as investigations were happening this past year. And people were really upset about that. So over the course of the summer, there were lots of changes to policy. We can talk about that. There were some really, I think, positive conversations about changes. However, right before school started, there was a letter that went public that Superintendent Forston had sent to staff, and it characterized the allegations against Lee Young, as well as the media coverage, as kind of dribble. There was a real negative connotation, and it made people feel like Forston hadn't in fact taken all these allegations seriously and wasn't properly engaged in the healing and the changes that the district is looking for right now. So the petition emerged after that saying, we no longer have trust in this leadership. They need to be removed.
And she's since apologized for that language.
She's apologized for that letter, yes.
But damage has kind of been done a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I should mention, as someone who had a child in the Concord school system for many years, I've been following this very closely. The Concord Monitor has been doing a lot of reporting. It's typically, top headline above the fold in most editions when something significant develops. And the biggest problem with the Forston letter, the superintendent, was said it's time to move on. And that concerned people because there is an independent investigation that is being done. And I think to a large extent, the fate of the superintendent and Principal Sicca really depends on what's in that report. The school board, which just met last week in a very contentious meeting, said that they're waiting to see what the report says before they make any final decisions. And I think, as Sarah mentioned, this has been an opportunity for some introspection, and they've developed some new policies and had some additional training and community engagement. But, my experience has been just generally when these kinds of things start to build, it's often very difficult to kind of reverse that momentum. I mean, the damage has been done, and we'll see what happens. Perhaps they'll both stay on, but a lot of times in these kinds of situations, people keep pressing for some sort of satisfactory outcome, which may mean that they're eventually replaced. We don't know yet. The board said they won't decide until they see this independent report, which I think is due sometime in September.
Well, I want to go to Sarah for this because, Sarah, you were at the meeting this week.
I was, yes.
This was, Leah Willingham wrote about this as well, an intense meeting. Take us there. What was it like?
Yeah, there were more than 100 people there. You could hear a little murmuring in the audience that there was some support or tentative support still for the board and for Forston, but it was generally parents and students and advocates who strongly believe that Forston and Sicca should be removed. And there were signs, the petition itself was delivered, and there were hours of testimony. I mean, when I did not get out of there until 10 p.m., because people felt really strongly that regardless of what the investigation says, and the investigation, as Dean said, should come out in September, fingers crossed, regardless of what it says, the loss of trust is permanent. And so people were basically saying, we want as much of that investigation as possible to go public. But at the end of the day, we're not going to base our opinions or concerns entirely on that investigation. We have enough proof that the leadership is not what we need moving forward, given the amount of trauma students have had and given the fact that students are currently in a school where they don't totally trust leadership. And if the point is to reinstate trust and to build a really different culture in the Concord School District, they say we need different leadership.
And when you say trust in leadership, the leaders you're referring to, is that Forston and Sicca, or does that also include the school board?
I think that depends on which parents and students you ask. There were certainly parents there who were really sympathetic with the situation that the board is in. They're in a tremendously difficult situation, and they do want to get as many facts as possible before making personnel decisions. And then there were other people who said, look, this happened on your watch. Children were harmed on your watch, board. So this is just as much your fault as it is the superintendent's.
The difference is the school board positions are elected in Concord. So, the voters could always punish the board members down the road if they decide they're unhappy with the performance of the board. Obviously, the principal and the superintendent, those are appointed by the board.
And, the optics were not great for this. So there was...
Not great for whom? For the school board?
For the school board and for the superintendent. So there was a presentation at the beginning of this meeting that was about changes that have been made, new policies, what sound to be really effective trainings that all staff went through in order to identify sexual harassment and help students report it better and cultivate a very different culture around reporting. However, Superintendent Forston was looking down much of the time as students were testifying. And so there were these very raw moments where students were saying, I was in a room by myself with Howie Leung, the special ed teacher, countless hours. I was there. I was unsafe. And I expect I expect a change, and I need to you need to kind of earn my trust again as a student who was in a really unsafe situation. And as that was happening, sometimes it was obviously a very difficult situation for the superintendent, but the fact that she was not looking at the students all the time, the fact that she was not looking at the parents providing testimony, she was called out for that. And it was, again, the optics were not good.
Mm-hmm. And so this is a highly litigious environment right now, as far as I understand, apart from Howie Leung, who is facing charges. It stands to reason that both the school board and, you know, Terry Forston have been in contact with lawyers, and they're being very careful about what they say. And also the school board, it would have a hard time speaking publicly about personnel issues. Boards generally aren't supposed to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of mounting pressure and the demand by parents and students for more transparency, we see this whenever there's a really contentious personnel issue. And there are, in fact, confidentiality concerns whenever there's a personnel issue, particularly involving reports and behavior of people under the age of 18. So there are, I think, legitimate reasons why there has not been full transparency yet, and why there are some conversations that need to happen behind closed doors.
Well, as we leave this subject, just want to confirm that the board chair, Jennifer Patterson, has agreed to release at least some of the investigation when it's released, yes?
She says she needs to see the investigation prior to knowing what can be released, but they do hope to release parts, yes.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and still to come, Mark Hayward, reporter for The Union Leader, will bring us up to speed on a few issues of great importance to the city of Manchester, including what Police Chief Carlo Capano has to say about the Hillsborough County Attorney's handling of a recent plea deal for two parents whose child died after getting into their stash of cocaine. There is a lot more to chat about today. Hit us up with an email if you've got questions. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. This is The Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
On Monday on The Exchange, we'll be talking with a local professor who extensively researched mass shooters for the FBI and says there are many warning signs before these shootings occur. That's Monday at 9 a.m. on The Exchange. But right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. In the studio with me, Sarah Gibson, NHPR education and Southern New Hampshire reporter, and Dean Spiliotis from SNHU. And on the phone for this part of the program is Mark Hayward, reporter for The Union Leader. He writes a column called City Matters. Hey, Mark, thanks very much for being on the show today.
My pleasure, Dean.
So, Mark, your story in The Union Leader this morning details how much trouble Hillsborough County Attorney Michael Conlon might be in. The Attorney General's office says it's exploring what steps to take against Conlon. So we want to spend some time getting the two conflicting sides of this dispute. So to start, Mark, why is the Attorney General's office so unhappy with Michael Conlon?
It's the latest problem was a plea bargain that was entered last Friday regarding two parents whose toddler died of a drug overdose. There was they were drug dealers. There was large amounts of drugs and cash in their apartment, and their 20-month-year-old son, Peyton Garvey, died of a cocaine overdose because he just crawled around and got exposed to the drugs. The plea bargain called for a sentence that even the judge thought was lenient. The father pleaded guilty to negligent homicide. He has to do 5 years behind bars, 2 years of drug treatment, and if he passes the drug treatment, he's out of prison. If he doesn't, he has to do a total of 10 years behind bars.
Go ahead.
Police Chief Carlo Capano didn't like that at all. He wanted 10 years behind bars as a very minimum, and he complained that he didn't know about this until it was on social media.
And that might be true, but how common would it have been for the county attorney to sort of go back to the police chief and sort of let them know what's to come?
Well, the police complained, saying that they used to have a relationship with the county attorney's office where plea bargains would be discussed, but they said that that's fallen apart. Attorney General Gordon McDonald's concerns that he doesn't think there's enough communication between police and the county attorney's office.
And as far as I understand the reporting you've done, Mark, Michael Conlon would tend to agree that communication is not that great, but he has an explanation for that, yes?
Sure. Conlon paints himself to be a person who steps in crisis and solves problems. He said he came into the office, it was underfunded. Prosecutors and secretaries and victim witness workers were overworked, and the morale was poor. And he says he's been working on those issues. He's hired new staff. He's got a double-digit increase with his budget this year, and he's pushing back. On Tuesday, he met with McDonald and his top deputy attorney general Jane Young, and they asked him to resign, and he said no.
What was his argument for not resigning?
He wrote a 4-page letter to them saying, I've made strides with the office, and said I'm willing to work with you. Please give me more resources. But he said he doesn't think resigning would be good for Hillsborough County office, the Hillsborough County Attorney's Office at this point.
And I want to get into what the Attorney General's office is thinking about doing next in a moment. But I do want to circle back to one thing, which is that the case we just mentioned about the parents whose child died after the child got into their stash of cocaine. That's not the only thing that folks have been upset with Michael Conlon's office about. Can you talk a little bit about some of those other things?
There's been some other cases earlier this year, and of course, he's only been on the job a year. Earlier this year, there was a case where a Franklin police officer pleaded guilty to a domestic-related charge, and that was based on some conditions. I'm sorry, he didn't plead guilty. The charges were dropped based on some conditions. But those conditions were confidential. There's nothing in state law that allows for that. The attorney general told him that violates the right to know law and the whole idea of open court proceedings, and so they had to release it. And then earlier this summer, a man named Damian C.S. Broke into the apartment of his girlfriend and beat her to death. And then in February, the county attorney's office, not particularly Mike Conlon, but one of the prosecutors, had dropped charges against C.S. brought by the woman who ended up to be his murder victim, brought by her on an earlier domestic. But she had said she had recanted her story and she didn't want the prosecution to go forward. But these things, it's been a steady drumbeat of cases that don't sit well with the attorney general.
And I want to bring Dean Spiliotis and then Sarah Gibson in. Dean.
Yeah, hi, Mark. So the Hillsborough County attorney is an elected position, and Conlon's a Democrat. He had been noted that he didn't have a lot of prior prosecutorial experience. I believe the attorney before him was a Republican who also sort of similarly lacked that kind of prosecutorial experience. I mean, to what extent does this feel, is there like a political component to this because these are elected positions, or is this just simply Conlon has a different view of kind of the institutional power of his position versus others and or just kind of communication issues? Do you feel there's a political dimension to this?
That's a great question. Political dimension when it comes to Republican-Democrat, I don't see that yet, but Conlon was a Democrat who ousted a Republican in a blue wave year. Police chiefs have been quietly but a little more vocally upset about Conlon, mostly with communication issues in the town of Merrimack. He told the Merrimack police chief that any animal abuse cases, even misdemeanor cases that usually the county attorneys don't get involved in, that he wanted oversight of those. So there's been political in that police chiefs are upset about Conlon. And I think when the police chief gets upset about something, they call the attorney general, that office listens.
Sarah Gibson.
Well, I think it's also worth noting that that Conlon has done something at the direction of the Attorney General, I think with the hopes of appeasing both the concerns of the police chief as well as the Attorney General. Just earlier last week, he started implementing a new policy, again, at the direction of the Attorney General, to basically be the last person that would sign off on a dropped charge. So, if there were a charge on drunk driving, on sexual assault, on domestic violence, the prosecutors couldn't, the overworked prosecutors who don't necessarily see Conlon every day, they would not necessarily just be able to decide, hey, we're going to drop this charge. In fact, it would have to go through with Conlon's desk. I think the hope with that is that there are fewer dropped charges against people who pose a real danger either to their partner or to the public. And this is, just having looked into this a little bit, this is a practice that some other county attorneys have, but in general, you don't necessarily have, a written policy at a county attorney's office saying that county attorney must look through every potential dropped charge prior to allowing it. The other thing worth noting is that there are other counties who every single time they're thinking of dropping a charge, talk to the police about it. So there, and those are sometimes smaller counties where it's just less overwhelming to deal with the cases. But I do think that there is a real range in New Hampshire of how much police chiefs are talking to the county attorneys. But certainly there had been far more communication in the past.
So Mark Hayward, in your article today in the Union Leader, you talk about how the Attorney General's office is exploring steps to figure out what to do about Michael Conlon. What's in their toolkit there? What could they possibly do?
Remember at 2013, something similar to this happened. Jim Reams was the Attorney General at the time, Joe Foster, stepped in and kind of took over at Rockingham County, where Jim Reams had been a longtime county attorney. At that point, though, you can't remove the county attorney. What I think he did was basically neuter him. And Reams came into an office and he got a paycheck, but he didn't have anything to do with the operation of the Rockingham County Attorney's Office. The difference here with that is Reams was accused of crimes and sexual harassment. Now, this is just people who think that Conlon isn't doing a good enough job. So what they can do, I think they can come in and say, we're taking over, the assistant county attorneys are going to report to us. When that happened in Rockingham County back in 2013, 2014, Reams went to court. His big argument was, I'm an elected official. You guys are appointed. That means something when you take over the power of someone who's been elected by the voters.
And that may be the case, but it's also the case that the Attorney General's office has some oversight over county attorneys.
Of course, yes, and that's written out in the law.
So what's the next step here? What are we waiting for as we watch the saga unfold?
We'll find out today.
We'll find out today. Okay. So perhaps by the rebroadcast of this show at 7 o'clock, our listeners should know to check the Union Leader or NHPR.org for updates.
Unionleader.com.
Thank you, Mark. So we're speaking with our guests today about the week's news. If you have questions or comments, send them our way. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. Or watch a live streaming video of this chat. Just go to Facebook and search for NHPR Exchange. That is all one word, NHPR Exchange. Unfortunately, we can't see Mark today. Mark's on the phone, but the rest of us are here in the studio. Mark, I do want to ask you about something else that's been happening in Manchester this week. Governor Sununu made a surprise appearance at a meeting at which Manchester City officials were discussing the state's response to the opioid crisis. So, Mark, what specifically was this meeting supposed to be about?
Well, it was a meeting that Joyce Craig and her health director, Anna Thomas, had been hoping for a long time with Commissioner Myers of Health and Human Services, because they wanted to discuss opioids with him. And Sununu kind of showed up, I don't want to say uninvited, but not unexpected. And after the meeting, he put out a press release saying, well, Manchester doesn't have an opioid response plan, and I'm happy to form some kind of a task force or a coordination team to help them figure out what to do with the opioid problem in Manchester.
And let me make sure I understand. So the objection that the city of Manchester had more or less was that they were working, they were trying to work collaboratively with the governor, and then the governor, almost as soon as the meeting is over, sort of kind of threw a little shade on the city and said, look, I'm the governor and I'm coming to step in and help the city. Is that kind of what's happening?
I think blindsided could be a good word to use in this case. They were a little surprised. The next day they held a press conference and they said the problem is not Manchester. We're dealing with the fact that the state hasn't been able to address the opioid crisis in an effective way. The doorway program, which is the main program to stem from the federal government's opioid response grant, that it's in operation, but people are still coming to Manchester, and they're frustrated with that situation. They don't think enough has been done in the other communities where there's supposed to be this hub where people can go and get quick entries into treatment or other help with their substance or alcohol abuse problem.
Dean Spillier.
Yeah, Mark just touched on it. I mean, the interesting unintended consequence or side effect of program design is trying to understand whether this new hub and spoke model is not sufficiently solving the problem, and or is it unintentionally in some way channeling more people into Manchester, so that would mean that the city would need greater resources in order to deal with the additional number of individuals seeking treatment. So this is an interesting. There was a lot of fanfare around this hub and spoke model. It was a big step forward in terms of getting people to the resources that they need. And now we get to see what is the impact of it on the biggest city in the state.
Sarah Gibson.
Well, I would say this is not new either, this disagreement. I mean, when the hub and spoke model was being announced just a little bit less than a year ago, there was already a lot of consternation from, you know, two major Democratic mayors, both in Nashua and Manchester, saying, we have not been included in this process. We're doing the bulk of the state's work to provide resources to people from all over the state who come here for treatment and come here for treatment beds and for various other resources. And we should be at the table with DHHS in planning this because we've been on the front lines for years now. So this resentment has been growing for months. And I think you even saw it in the very early rollout of hub and spoke, saying, you know, we're holding our breath. We're waiting to see whether or not this in fact takes off some of the pressure on Manchester, particularly, and also to some extent Nashua. We'll wait and see. And it's been more than 6 months since the hub and spoke model got started. And I think there is just it's kind of gotten to the point where they say this has not helped us at all. In fact, it's made this system has in fact made our jobs harder.
Yeah, and you can go back even before the hub and spoke model with the Safe Stations program. I remember hearing the same kinds of concerns that, you know, with these safe stations in the fire departments in Manchester being overwhelmed by people coming in from elsewhere, not just Manchester, to try to seek treatment and help.
Mark, does your understanding jive with what's being said?
Yeah, Dean, that was a good point. The fire department and the ambulance service point out that last year, out-of-city visitors to Safe Station had actually gone down to about 43%, and now this year it's up to 50%. I think they think that, hey, we were taking care of the problem by ourselves, and now the doorway model hasn't working, and people are still coming into Manchester. Chris Staywas, who's the director of the ambulance service here, the AMR ambulance service, he said that the part of the problem is people still think of Safe Station. The doorway, no one really thinks of doorway if they want to get drug treatment. Safe Station is still in their mind, and the only Safe Stations right now are in Manchester and Nashua, so people are going there. It could be simple as that.
And so, Mark, how important is it that the governor's office and leaders in Manchester stay on the same page when it comes to handling the opioid crisis?
You would, of course, it's important. You, the state fund. funds, the state provides the funding. Manchester has everything in place right now too, and that's part of the problem. There are Farnham Center has both an residential treatment and an outpatient treatment facility. If you go to the doorway or the safe station in Manchester, you're gonna end up in a program pretty quickly. It's established. Manchester wants that to continue, and it's only going to continue with opioid response funding, with Medicare and Medicaid expansion.
Other stories the NHPR newsroom's been following this week. The Trump administration announced that New Hampshire will receive more than $26 million in a new round of federal grants to combat the opioid crisis. The bulk of that money, $22 million, comes from funding that was approved by Congress in 2018. Also, after 1 year, a Catholic school in Claremont is closing its doors. Low enrollment at John Paul II Academy meant there wasn't enough capital for the school year. The school had opened last fall and served pre-K through grade 12. But in the North Country, two Catholic schools have opened in the past 2 years, one in Lancaster and another just this week in Gorham. More than 5,000 New Hampshire students attend Catholic schools. And Governor Chris Sununu signed two bills this week banning the use of some products that contain PFAS chemicals. The industrial compounds were phased out of American manufacturing years ago, but may be present in older or imported items. They've been linked to a wide array of health problems. One bill bars the import, manufacture, or sale of furniture and carpeting containing levels of PFAS, and the other bars the use of a PFAS-based firefighting foam. Mark Hayward, one more story before the break to discuss with you. The Union Leader reported this week that Manchester's population of homeless people is, quote, surging. What does the surge look like?
You see it when you walk around the city. You see homeless people camping overnight and sleeping overnight in some of the parks along some roadsides. The shelter, which usually is only full in the winter, has about 160 people living in it during the night where it rained a lot last week. So those are numbers that you might see in February, but not in August or September.
And so what has the city's response been for people who are homeless?
Well, I think this is going to be one of the major political issues of the mayoral election and the city election that's coming up, that's taking place this year. Joyce Craig, the mayor, announced a new program to address the homeless, which would include possibly banning camping in city parks. And she's a little vague, but she wants to have an ordinance that would allow prohibit trespassing on public properties in certain cases. And she wants the city to spend upwards of $150 million to bring in consultants who say they've had successful homeless problems directed towards the homeless in San Antonio.
Mark Hayward is a reporter for the Union Leader. Mark, thank you very much for being on the Roundup today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Peter.
And NHPR Sarah Gibson, thank you for being on the program today.
You're welcome.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It's still to come. Democratic State's Majority Leader Dan Feltes is officially running for governor. What do you make of his candidacy? You can let us know by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post your comments on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We will finish up rounding up the week's news after a break.
I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction. Or you could just give us hundreds of dollars directly. We'd like that a lot. And thank you.
Learn more about donating your old car or truck at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And on the line with us now is Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington News correspondent with WBUR. Kimberly, thank you very much for being on the line with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We'll get to you in a little bit. I want to talk about ranked choice voting in New Hampshire, in Massachusetts, which may be the envy of some voters here in New Hampshire. But first, I want to talk to Dean a little bit about two major declarations here in statewide races. One of them has to do with Dan Feltes, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader. He announced his run for governor formally this week. It's been coming for a while. Dean, how did he define his candidacy in this first formal message to voters?
Well, people who follow state legislative politics are very familiar with Dan Feltes. He's a three-term state senator. He's a lawyer. Prior to his political career, he worked for New Hampshire Legal Assistance. As you mentioned, he's Senate Majority Leader. He's 40 years old. He's the youngest individual ever to be the Senate Majority Leader. He has run on a suite of progressive issues. People identify him with family medical leave, full-day kindergarten, Medicaid expansion in particular. As Senate Majority Leader, he's been intimately involved in the whole issue of revising work requirements here in New Hampshire. Work requirements have been challenged in courts around the country. There's been the expectation that he was going to run for some time now. He's been viewed as kind of an up-and-coming Democratic politician even before he got into the state Senate.
Quick status check on that race. We've heard from Executive Counselor Andrew Walensky as thinking about a run, but he has not officially declared yet.
He is not officially in the race yet, although observers say it's pretty likely. The other name we just talked about, Joyce Craig, mayor of Manchester, I don't know to what extent she's considering running, but she is someone who, in any discussion I've had about what the Democratic primary might look like, of course, Feltes and Walensky. In fact, I think Walensky was actually the first one to say he was considering it, and now Feltes is in before him. But Joyce Craig also typically comes up in the discussion. Whether or not she's actively considering it, I don't know.
Okay. Worth mentioning, too, another name jumping into a major race in New Hampshire, Corky Messner, is going to challenge Senator Jean Shaheen, or at least in the Republican primary, he's put his name into the hat. How does Corky Messner define himself?
Yeah, this is really interesting. He's the third individual to get into the Republican primary for U.S. Senate. He's a former Army Ranger and West Point grad, founded a Denver law firm that now I believe has a number of offices, and moved here a little over a year ago, took up residence in Wolfboro. He's running as an outsider, not surprisingly, sort of fairly standard Republican critique of Jean Shaheen, that she's a far-left politician, a career politician, the types of arguments that we've heard from others as well. And he is going to, he supports Trump. He's talked a lot about the need to build the wall. So he's on board with Trump's immigration policy. He's right now up against retired Brigadier General Don Bolduc, who got into the race already, and former House Speaker Bill O'Brien, who many political observers know well. You know, the big outstanding question here in all of this is Corey Lewandowski, Donald Trump's former campaign manager. He's actively considering getting into the race. Donald Trump has been very encouraging. If he gets into the race, I would not be surprised to see Trump put his finger on the scale for Lewandowski. He's done that in other races, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But until Lewandowski makes a decision, all of this other getting into the race almost feels like it's being overshadowed, because Lewandowski would change the visibility of the race nationally. It would bring in a lot of outside money, and it would be very polarizing. And there's even a debate within the Republican Party here in New Hampshire about whether or not him getting into the race would be good or bad for New Hampshire Republican politics.
Well, early days for both the Senate race and the governor's race. We'll check in with you again on that, I'm sure, at some point, Dean. But I want to turn now to Kimberly Atkins, because, Kimberly, I'd love to ask you about something your station, WBUR, reported on this week, and that's the petition to implement ranked choice voting in Massachusetts. This might be something voters in New Hampshire, some voters anyway, would like, given how many choices we have in the Democratic primary this year and how many choices Republican primary voters had in 2016. Kimberly, who's behind this petition?
Yeah, so there is a petition. It's something that has been gaining some some popularity and talk across the country among a lot of groups who believe that the way that voting currently is done isn't entirely fair, and it results in people who have a plurality or less than a majority support really being able to win campaigns. So Massachusetts now will put to voters as to whether they want to employ ranked choice voting, which is how it works, is you voters would vote for each office that has ranked choice. They would rank their choices: top choice, second choice, third choice. And so in an election, if one person gets a clear 50% margin, then that person wins. If not, then the lower choices of the candidates who have the lowest amount of support would drop out, and then the tabulation would be done based on the remaining folks who are still in it, and whoever gets the majority there would win on the ballot. It's controversial, but it's something that is being considered in states like Maine, and now Massachusetts will take it up.
And what are some of the arguments against it? I mean, it seems like for places where there are a lot of candidates and many voters may like more than one, they would like it. But what's the argument against it?
Yeah, so some say that just logistically it would be a messy process. It would be unclear to voters exactly how the choice is being made. Others say it would discourage candidates from tackling tough issues for fear of alienating some voters. And others say, look, it just goes against the basic principle in the Constitution of one person, one vote, because you'll technically be voting for multiple people in an election.
And have there been occasions in Massachusetts, since this would be a Massachusetts thing, where voters may have benefited from this?
Yes. I mean, take, for example, a recent election of Fall River Mayor Jaisal Correa. He was someone who was charged with tax fraud and wire fraud in connection with an investment scheme. And he ran for re-election at the same time and on the same ballot that there was a recall petition for him. Now, the majority of people voted in favor of the recall petition, but because he got a plurality of the vote, not a majority of the vote, in the actual re-election, the recall failed. So that's an example where the will of the people seemed pretty clear, but the result of the election was the opposite.
Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, ranked choice voting is something political scientists love talking about. I remember studying it in one of my first graduate courses over 30 years ago. So this is an idea that's been around for a long time. It is gaining a little more currency now. Most recently, I read about it, and others may have read about it in Maine. You recall Maine had it for a while, for I think two terms, had a controversial Republican Governor LePage. And there was a study that came out that showed that if there had been ranked choice voting, he would not have been elected or reelected. The problem was there was a third-party candidate that complicated the ability for Democrats to keep him out of office. So that got a little bit of attention in Maine, and Maine has gone on to do some experimenting with this as well. But this is something that people often look to get a more fine-grained sense of voter preferences. But as Kimberly mentioned, there are a lot of logistical issues with this as well. It can become very unwieldy and complicated when you're dealing with a large field.
Well, we've got a link to that story up at nhpr.org. Feel free to check it out, listeners, if you're interested in learning more about what Massachusetts is thinking about with respect to ranked choice voting. Kimberly, I wanted to ask you about Vice President or former Vice President Joe Biden. He's running for president, of course. And NHPR reported this week that he's under scrutiny for a report that a war story he recounted on the campaign trail was inaccurate. He sat down for an interview this week and he responded that the details are irrelevant in terms of decision making. So broadly speaking, though, Kimberly, I wanted to ask you about what you make of the state of the Biden campaign.
Yes. I mean, Joe Biden's campaign as of right now is still quite strong. He is still technically the front runner, early as it is in the race. But it is instances like this. He's long been known for misspeaking, for making gaffes on the campaign trail throughout his political career. And this seems like another example of that. As you said, he's trying to address it and say he doesn't see what the big deal is. The point of the story he was telling was about the heroism of a member of the military who did not want to receive an award, and that is really what heroism is about. He may have gotten the facts wrong, but when you have a crowded field like the Democrats have in this primary, and when you have a lot of other candidates like Senator Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who are really on Joe Biden's heels, things like this can make a difference.
And, Dean, you want to
Yeah, just a quick point from, you know, my sense from talking to Democrats here in New Hampshire is that the queasiness around this issue is not so much that Joe Biden has a history of making gaffes. Everyone acknowledges that. He acknowledges it as well and tried to laugh it off on the Colbert Show the other night. But the concern I hear from Democrats is this simply more of Joe Biden, the gaffe machine, or is this a function of something else, perhaps diminished capacity as a result of age? But that's a very big, that's a very sensitive question to talk about. And so that's the concern I hear quietly from Democrats. Is this just a typical gaffe, or is this something else that may actually be problematic for him as he gets into his mid-late 70s as a general election candidate? We don't know the answer to that, but that's where the queasiness is among Democrats who support him.
Kimberly Atkins, another Democratic debate's coming up next week. One night, 10 candidates. Winnowing really has begun. What are you expecting out of next week's debate?
I think the real big draw for that debate is this will be the really the first time we see Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden on a stage together, side by side, and how they choose to go after each other or not go after each other. We saw in past debates Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, for example, really avoid firing at each other, both aware that they're appealing largely to the same kind of folks within the party and not really wanting to hurt themselves. But at the same time, they're both at the heels, as I said, of Joe Biden. They're going to be flanking him on that stage. And I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the attention. I think you're going to see some other folks to try to break through, folks like Senator Cory Booker, Senator Kamala Harris, both of whom had a little bit of momentum but seem to have lost it, try to break through too. But I think a lot of people will be relieved that it is only one night. I know I will.
But 3 hours, right? Easier. Isn't it supposed to be a three-hour?
Yes, oh, boy. It will be three hours, which, I mean, even the first two went over 2 hours. They both seem very long. So the fact that it's one night, I think, is a little easier on voters as well as us reporters.
It's still 10 candidates, though, which really disappoints me. I would love to see 5, 6, or 7. We'll get there eventually, but it's still, in some senses, it's not two nights of it, but it is still 10 candidates, which can be a little unwieldy.
Did you just long for the days when a small stage of candidates was 6 or 7?
that would sound good to me right about now. even 8, maybe.
Well, Dean, I want to thank you today for being on the show. Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent with WBUR. Thank you very much for joining us for today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Peter.
And that's it for today. But remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Dan Tuohy is working the cameras today. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.